Welcome to the Short Term Show, the show about short-term rentals and long-term wealth, with real property owners hosting real properties who are crushing it in the vacation and short-term rental space. And here's your host, Avery Carl.
This episode of the Short-Term Show is brought to you by The Short-Term Shop. If you're interested in buying a short-term rental in one of the top vacation markets in America, just go to theshorttermshop.com and click Get Connected with an Agent. If you purchase a home with the shop, you'll have access to all of our client-only benefits, such as training on how to manage your short-term rental. So we'll teach you everything you need to know, from how to set up your Airbnb and Vrbo listings, to how to use the property management software that you'll need to streamline your business, all the way down to helping you source your local boots on the ground, like cleaners, handy people, etc. We've taught thousands of people just like you how to buy and manage their vacation homes from anywhere in the world. So head on over to theshorttermshop.com and click Get Connected with an Agent to get started. I do have to mention that we're brokered by eXp or else I get in trouble. We'll see you guys over there. Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of the Short Term Show. Today we have a part two of a very early Short Term Show guest. We have Brian Cataldi. He came on, I believe it was March of 2022. He was just at the beginning of rehabbing a small five cabin development.
Seven
cabin development. Yeah. And we're now at the end of that. So we're doing a follow-up. We are going to have a walkthrough of it on our YouTube channel. So be sure to check that out. But Brian, how's it going?
It's good. How you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Are you tired?
Yes, I'm worn down. This has been a lot.
Yeah. So guys, if you're not familiar with Brian's story, be sure to check out part one of this episode series. Again, March of 21, he came on. He was just at the beginning. He just bought this 7-unit cabin development and it was totally trashed, right? There's one particularly creepy picture of this place that I can't get over, where somebody had written 12-toed Tom on the wall. And I would like to know what that is personally, but I don't think we'll ever know.
I would too. That's like devil symbols scratched into the, you know, written on the wall. It's crazy.
Yeah, I have nightmares about 12-toed Tom.
Crazy stuff.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about, just give us a refresher of how you found this place, what it looked like, and then we'll kind of get into all the work you put into it.
Yeah. I found it off market. Derek actually brought it to me, Tellier from the Short-Term Shop. A local guy had it here and it was a long-term rental. There were six cabins at the top of this development. There was one at the bottom. And that was it. There was nothing in between. And, you know, once you do the walkthrough, you'll kind of see that now we've had a pretty major developer come in here and put cabins all through the bottom. But what it looked like was a horror show, an absolute horror show. I couldn't get into a lot of them. They were long-term rented. This one in particular had tumbleweeds of dog hair. Couldn't even use the bathtub. Like the bathtub was so gross. They had drug needles and walls. We had appliances we pulled out that they had leftover meat in. So you can imagine the smell of these places. They were pretty much terrible. So we kind of started over. So.
Tell us what Cash for Keys is real quick for those who might not be familiar.
They had people in here that I think were not paying rent. They were basically squatting at this point. The old owner, I basically told him like, hey, I'm not buying this. Let those people are out of here. I'm not going to deal with that. And so he basically paid them to get on out of here and move somewhere else. And I think he had another couple apartment buildings in town. So he wound up moving them over there.
Keeping
plus giving them cash.
He kept them.
Yep.
Gosh.
Yep.
Okay. So these were in pretty bad disrepair.
They're rough.
Was it all cosmetic or was there any structural stuff you had to do to them?
Yeah. So the big story out of this one, you know, I came up here naive. I'd never done really anything. I kind of knew how to hang a picture and that was about it. My father knew quite a bit. So he knew what he was looking at and he was kind of like, you're insane, but we'll help you. So the cabins themselves were in pretty good shape in terms of the structure of them. We had some problems, especially plumbing and that kind of thing that we've had to kind of go through and take a look at. But structurally, you know, they're on a slab. We don't have any crazy, roof and mechanical type stuff problems. Of course, a lot of what we did was start over anyway with everything. So we kind of redid them all. But electrical wiring, all that stuff's in pretty good shape. What I didn't see was the infrastructure that kind of went with this place.
Oh.
And so we had a well at the bottom. And what I was told initially was there was two wells, a well at the bottom and a well at the top. And the well at the top fed these six and the well at the bottom fed the one at the bottom. What we found out going through this was there was a well at the bottom. The well at the bottom pushed water through a massive pipe up the mountain that we never have located. I know that the construction guys down there have hit it a couple times. We never did find it. But anyway, push water through the pipe and then up to a transfer station with a booster pump that then scattered it to these cabins. That was going to be the Achilles heel of this place. And once we kind of figured that out, we knew that there was going to be some problems there. Well, luckily or unluckily for me, I don't know which, we've dealt with a lot, but a developer came in at the bottom and then built a bunch of cabins down there. And part of doing that wound up putting us on city water. The city kind of made them do that. Nice. So that solved a lot of that problem, but there was a lot of headache involved in that. We had to excavate, tear up the roads that were here, do kind of everything that we needed to do with that just to get these things hooked back up. So there was a lot that kind of went into that. We had to rebuild every retaining wall in this place, one of them. Every
That's
single
expensive,
one of them.
Right?
That was significantly expensive. I think where I kind of fell was I saw cabins to remodel. I didn't see all the other things that went with it on the outside. So we spent a significant amount of money trying to get the outside grounds shaped up. And then once the developer came in, he tore up the roads. So we had to wind up, you know, replacing all the roads up here. And now he's back and we've got him kind of tore up again. But I think this time around, he's going to wind up probably having to do them all. So in terms of infrastructure, there was a lot more here than I think I knew going in.
I think that's probably a pretty common mistake because a lot of people want to go, you know, buy a piece of land, build a few things, maybe plop some teepees or some domes or whatever. And they don't think about, oh, I've got to have roads. I've got to have water. I've got to have sewer for all of these things. And a lot of times that requires having to subdivide them and do all of these things, retaining walls. So I think that that's definitely a really great call out for our listeners who might be wanting to do the same thing is don't neglect that infrastructure piece.
Yeah. That was the piece that I certainly, that was probably the biggest learning experience for me was seeing all that stuff on the outside that I didn't understand nor understood how much it would cost to kind of deal with some of that stuff. That was a big one, probably the biggest learning piece. This redoing these was, don't get me wrong, a ton of work, but this was doable. The outside stuff we couldn't even do. So,
gotcha. Yeah. So what has been your strategy with these? Because you live on the property. So what's been your strategy for rehabbing them? Are you doing them all at one time, like doing all the floors and all seven at once and going up, or doing one whole rehab at a time?
Yeah. So me and my parents, for the most part, kind of sat down at the beginning of this. And we're like, how are we going to do this? And at the point that we had the last podcast with you, I still had a contractor. So the plan was the contractor is going to do the outside of each one of these first so that when we get them done, it at least looks like we don't just have horror shows next to each other, right? So at least the outsides were done. Brought a guy up that started doing some of the landscaping and tried to take care of that first so that when we got to the point that we could rent them, you know, at least it looked presentable. Right after the podcast I did with you, we actually had to let the contractor go because that's how that goes.
That's
how that goes.
Yes. If you haven't let one go, you have not done
You've not been a part of it. He's a good guy. We still stay in contact. He's still done some projects for me, but I think he was in a little bit over his head. And we figured that out fairly early on. I'm an accountant by trade, CPA. I was looking at kind of the money that
we
had.
You're an accounting professor, not just like some accountant.
Yeah. So I kind of had I knew just gut feel kind of where we were with money. I only had a limited, it's not like I had tons of money. This was my cash that we brought to the table to do these. And I could see where we were headed with that. Plus the stuff they were getting done wasn't getting done right. And so we'd have to come in basically and redo a lot of it.
Yeah.
Yep. So we had to let them go. And I kind of looked at my dad, who's, 74 now and retired and said, hey, we can do this. And, he, of course, was real thrilled with that and came up and helped me out to redo them. So our strategy from there was, at that point, we pretty much had a box on the inside. We had the outsides done, and we needed to do a bunch of landscaping, and then we had to do the interiors of these. So we did the 4 one-bedrooms first. What we're sitting in right now is a one-bedroom, what I consider a one-bedroom. Mm-hmm. About 450 square feet, roughly. There were two that had a loft in them. So we did those last. That was kind of our plan. So we'll get the 4 one-bedrooms done and we would do them like an assembly line. Like we did the floors and pretty much all of them. We had the kitchen we'd do in this one and then we'd go to the next one and do the kitchen in it. So that because once you do one of them, they're all set up basically the same. Mm-hmm. So we could kind of just make it like an assembly line. So we put all four online at once. And we did that in the beginning of 2023. And then we had two to go. And I've worked on each of those separately and finally finished up the last one here last weekend. So.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So are they all finished at this point?
All six are done. Six. There were seven total. We flipped the one at the bottom. So I sold it. Yeah, kept the six up here at the top. So yeah, they're all done.
Have any of them been available to rent for an entire year yet?
Oh yeah, all four last year.
Okay, how'd they do? Why is that funny?
I think people are astonished when I don't share numbers a lot. I share it with people privately, but the one next door to us did $75,000.
And it's a one bedroom?
450 square foot one bedroom.
My goodness.
75. The rest of them did. This one did 68. I think we averaged right around $70,000 last year. They stayed booked to the point where I think we were 92 or 93% occupied. It was wild. Wow. They've done well. Done well.
And guys, if that interests you and you want to see what these things look like, again, YouTube channel, we're going to do a walkthrough with Brian of all of these. And all the ones that are available, three. So you'll be able to see three of them and what they look like. So that brings me to my next question of size of property. So many people, they look at all these stats and data of what size property they need to do. And then they almost always, as a matter of fact, I've seen one person, Pavan Matarada, was episode two of this podcast, who always goes to the small ones. Everybody else looks and they say, okay, well, four bedrooms and up are a small percentage of this market, or five bedrooms and up. And they always go huge. And that's fine. Those do well. But if you look at almost any market, I'm not going to say every market, and I'm talking about vacation markets. I'm not talking about metro markets where these little things would be competing with a hotel. But in every vacation market that I've looked at extensively, studios and one bedrooms are less than 1% of the inventory on the market. And I think that that's very smart to go the small bedroom route. But a lot of people would rather just have 1 5 bedroom rather than 5 1 bedrooms. Mm-hmm. So what's your take on that?
So we started this, and the first property I ever got was a one bedroom loft, which essentially we ran as a two. And then we bought this project, and it wasn't that I wanted really small things at the beginning. It's just that this project had basically one bedrooms in it. So strategically, we just kind of fell into that. But during that, we did make a strategic decision that I wanted basically one bedroom properties. There's a reason for that. They don't make as much money. Usually, typically they don't. However, you don't have to deal with a lot of the headaches that come with a five bedroom property. Mm-hmm. I don't have to deal with 15 people. I've got two. And for the most part, they run in here, they do what they do, and I don't really talk to them unless I reach out or need to. Unless something goes wrong, I don't have to deal with that. So strategically, I like one bedrooms, and now that's pretty much just like Pavan, what I've done. I've pretty much just bought one bedroom properties for the most part. In fact, I've got one that's 275 square feet.
Oh my goodness.
And did roughly $59,000 last year.
Wow.
It's crazy. So, you know, if you run them well, run them right, there's just less headache involved. And I think that's one of the reasons we did it. The other reason was just kind of like you mentioned, there's a lot of development going on, especially in the Smokies right now. Developers make more money by sticking another floor on the thing and adding three bedrooms. It doesn't cost that much more. They get a premium for the square footage that they're building. And the reality is they don't want to touch one bedroom property. So for me, I think that's a pretty wise area to be, is one bedrooms, or if you can play in the space that a lot of people can't get to on the other side of this, which is kind of above that, really high price point, very, very large property. Everything in between is just tougher. Not to say it's impossible to do, you can do it and do it well, but it's a squeeze, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. I do love, like, our little studio does about $60,000 a year, and it's not, I mean, it's cute. We've updated it, but it's by no means like a luxury property. Yeah,
there's nothing, as you stand in here, there is nothing luxury. It's got its amenities. It's got some views. We're close to town, all the things, but it's nothing. We didn't put granite countertops. We didn't do some luxury styling here. It's just basic stuff.
So just cute, clean, and comfortable.
Yeah, man.
This episode is brought to you by Short-Term Rental Listing Advice. Join this Facebook group and post your listing to get advice from other hosts, including myself, on how you can improve your listing. Or just post your property so you can show off. Join us at strlistingadvice.com. That's strlistingadvice.com. Management Monday is proud to present this episode of the Short Term Show. Management Monday is a weekly course that will teach you everything you need to know about managing a short-term rental from a distance. How to get more bookings, higher ADR, how to hire and fire vendors. Even if you don't want to manage it yourself, you need this course so you know how to manage your manager. Over 10,000 superhosts started their career with Management Monday. And the best part is, it's free for short-term shop clients. Start your journey today at theshorttermshop.com. Theshorttermshop.com.
So what are some other pitfalls that you would hope that people who are listening might avoid if they take on this kind of project?
A rehab project?
Yeah.
Yeah. The number one thing with rehabs is expect the unexpected. So, you know, I didn't think I was a super control freak, but I'm pretty big about control. I think that's why we all kind of go in this, is we want to have some control over our life and our destiny in some way, shape, or form. And there's so many things that happen in a rehab that you can't control.
Right.
You know, for example, I mean, each one's got a story, but we went down to the one on the end called the Steely Dan. That's what I named it. The Steel Blue, and my dad's name was Dan, and it was his favorite. So we went in there, and we turned on the water. I had the cabin shut down over that winter freeze that happened in 22, 23, right?
And so
The Christmas one. We started the remodel pretty much right after that, but it was shut down. You know, the water wasn't on, and I was like, we're good. Well, copper piping in there, and I think there must have been water in the pipes in some way, shape, or form. So when we turned the water on, it rained from every roof, wall. It was awful, right? And so, you know, you kind of have that going on with any rehab project. You're going to open something up, open a wall up, and find out, oh no, we have so much more that we have to do. And so that's probably the biggest pitfall. That's not if it's a pitfall. It's just something you have to be aware of going in. You've got a budget. You've got kind of an idea of what you think is going to happen. And then reality is going to be significantly different by the time you're done. So,
yeah, I think that's great advice. A lot of people just like stuff happens, like things pop up that you're like, oh stuff crap, happens. I didn't realize I needed to rebuild this entire deck or what have you. So
the other big one for me was, you know, the development below us. I mean, the development below us was, I could never have planned for that. When we started this project, that didn't exist. And so, you know, construction and all the things that happen kind of around you impact you in a significant way. And that wound up costing me a bunch of time, which, you know, at the time that we were developing these or building these, rebuilding these, I was lighting a $5,000 check every month, you know, just lighting it on fire. And, you know, it cost me about 3 months in time. And then, like I said, they tore the roads up and stuff. And so I wound up having to spend all this money that I didn't have on roads, went to my 401k to do it. I was to the point when we started renting these in 23, where I had nothing left. Like, it was like, these have to work. So, yeah. But yeah, just expect the unexpected, and that's part of the gig. So
I totally agree with that. So let's talk about your management of these. Mm-hmm. So what tools are you using? Like, what's your property management software? Because you got five, and that's a significant jump to go from zero to five. Well, actually, you have more than that. How many do you have total?
All said and done, I'll have nine. I've got one over there that we're running right, actually two in Sky Harbor that we're running right now, which is about 15 to 20 minutes that way in another development. And then I've got four up here that are running right now. This one that we're in right now is shut down, and shut down because I've got construction going on literally on the other side of this. So, you know, I figured I'd shut it down and not deal with the headache of all of that. And because of how I bought these, we kind of have the luxury to do that. But anyway, so total, it'll be nine. I've got six up here in this development that will be running. We've got five will be running, I think, by the end of the month, probably by the end of April.
So, okay. Yeah. And are they all in the Smokies?
Yeah, all in Smokies. Yep.
And are they all one bedrooms or two bedrooms?
Basically. Yeah. I actually took a couple of the two bedrooms and made them one bedrooms. So now I own all one bedroom properties.
I have never heard of somebody downsizing. I've heard of people adding bedrooms, mm-hmm. but not subtracting. So what's the logic behind that?
Yeah, so we had one in Sky Harbor that was one bedroom with a loft. We had a couple of twin beds up in the loft and had a kids area up there. It's kind of funny. So I've got this 275 square foot. It was an office that was part of this other cabin that we bought.
And
the main cabin's two bedrooms. This one was one bedroom. Well, it was an office. It wasn't even a cabin. We redid it into a cabin, and it was a tiny 275 square foot one bedroom cabin. That's the one that did $59,000 last year. It wound up paying for the entire property. So we held off the remodel on the main cabin until this year, and that's the last one we've got. And then next to it, I've got this this one bedroom with a loft. Well, this one had kids and families. That was kind of its marketing, right? This one was couples, and specifically 18 or maybe 19 to 30, somewhere in there. That's the age range. I mean, you got to climb a ladder up into a loft, and that's how you sleep, right? So it's not going to be marketed towards everybody.
Okay, so wait, the property that you have to climb a ladder to get into a loft to sleep did $59,000.
$59,000.
That's really inconvenient. It's like, I would not rent that.
Yes.
And it did that much.
Did.
Wow.
It's unique.
Okay,
it's unique, and it competed on a little bit cheaper price point, and because of that, it just stayed relatively booked.
Okay, sorry. Go ahead. I just had to point that out.
But anyway, so yeah, so that thing did really well, and I never got complaints, and I never heard anything from anybody. And then this one was families and kids, and it was constantly problems and constantly just the road going up to it's pretty steep. Moms always complained about the road. Nobody complained over here. Finally, I was like, you know what? I'm done with this. Like, I'm gonna pull the loft apart. And so, beginning of this year, we pulled the loft apart, put a movie theater up there. I took the beds out, made a popcorn bar, put a king size bed, learned some things along the way in this project that we decided to do up there. Changed kind of just some of the pictures and did some of that stuff. That thing has been my best performing property ever since. So
it performs better as a one bedroom. Like, it makes more money as a one bedroom than it did as a two.
Yeah. And the reason for that, I think, is as a two bedroom, it was a small two bedroom without a lot of amenities competing against, if you look at the two bedroom space now, everybody that entered the market with new properties tended to enter them in a two bedroom space or up. And so they did that. Now I'm competing with the things that I enemy method and look at. I'm like, man, I have to compete on price. I can't compete on, I don't have game rooms and I don't have all this stuff, right? Yeah. And it's not a brand new property. It doesn't have ridiculous views. It's got a view, but it doesn't have ridiculous views. And so finally I said, I'd rather be at the top of the heap of a one bedroom than the bottom of the heap of a two bedroom. And so far that strategy has, knock on wood, worked out fairly well.
So. Awesome. That is definitely new. I've never heard of somebody downsizing a property and then it does better than when it was bigger.
So far, maybe it's just because I know how to manage one bedrooms better, but I think that's, it's got every amenity you could ever want for a one bedroom at that point. So it's done. Yeah.
So how have you financed all of these?
Yeah, we did a commercial loan on this one up here. I had no business getting that loan whatsoever. I was teaching in Indianapolis at the time that we were trying to put this deal together. From a commercial property standpoint, Tennessee State Bank did it as a portfolio loan. So all six, seven, I guess, were done together. That said, they are partitioned to where I can finance them conventionally. It's just that to do it conventionally would have been closing costs on each additional or each property at the time, which we were kind of, you know, stuck with a limited amount of money. I didn't want to do that. We had a pretty good, and we could get it done, right? So they were looking at from the commercial standpoint, they were looking at what the property could do. So I had a whole business plan spreadsheet, kind of like a DSCR loan, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas if we were going to do a conventional, it was looking at me. And at the time that I was doing this, my life was kind of falling apart. So I was like, I don't know where what that's going to look like in terms of my income and those kind of things. So we did a commercial loan up here. We did first property I ever did was conventional. So I've got one conventional. This is one commercial. Sold the one at the bottom. They were able to kind of add another one into this portfolio loan, which was the ADU and the two bedroom property that's over in Sky Harbor right next to each other. So we wrapped that one in. I wound up doing a 1031 exchange on that one at the bottom. I am no cash into that deal. And basically I've got all the rehab plus the down payment that came out of the one at the bottom. So that's how we got it structured right now. It's basically two commercial loans and then one conventional.
Okay. Yeah. I think that a lot of people they have a hard time finding commercial loans because you have to go so local. You can't just, there's not a big national commercial lender. And if there is, my guess is it's not any good. Mm-hmm. Not something you want to use. So what advice do you have for somebody who might want to buy something that has multiple units so they can't do conventional or even DSCR and finding a commercial lender to do something like this?
I've been fortunate, I think, in that I'm here. Mm-hmm. And if you are going to try to attempt something like this, you kind of have to be plugged into the local the local network, I guess, if you will. And so, you know, probably the best way to do that is through the real estate agents that you're working with who are local and can kind of point you in the right place. Mm-hmm. The guy that I bought this from had a relationship with Tennessee State Bank and the VP of you know, commercial lending over there. And so I wound up having to sit down with him. And of course, he didn't know who I was. We were bringing a lot of cash to the table and he knew what the deal was and he knew the guy that was selling it and said, we'll take a flyer on it. And so that's kind of where it started. Now, of course, you've got enough of a relationship there that I feel like I could go to them at this point. And if I had the right deal, they'd be like, heck yeah, let's do it.
Okay. So
that's the other thing. That's the other key to all of this is you've got to have a deal. Like, if you have a deal, if you have something that looks good on paper and that is truly a deal, you will find a way to get it financed because that's what the banks are kind of, every investor, everybody is looking for that. And that's the hardest part of it. So having the deal in your hand, is probably the biggest key to all of it. And then from there, you will find a way, I think, to get it financed. So.
Awesome. So anything else that we haven't covered that you feel like the listeners would benefit from hearing before we get to the last three questions of the show?
Oh man, I could write a book on this entire project. You know, so many things have happened along the way and it was so stressful. it's interesting to be on this side of it now because there are parts of it that I don't even think I remember. I've almost blocked out. So yeah, it's been a lot of fun. I have learned an absolute ton, you know, from a guy who could hardly hang a picture. I feel like we pretty much can do just about anything now. So kind of got a PhD in real estate over the last three and a half years. Being on site has helped a lot. Not something I want to do long term, but it works for now. And it really, really has helped in the management of it. The other thing is, you know, you got to be hungry. When we started this or got to the point where we're going to rent these, I think it was January, I launched four of these at once. And everybody was like, oh, it's okay. You're probably just going to rent weekends and that's how it's going to work. And I was like, that's unacceptable. Like I have no money left. Like we won't pay the mortgage if that's how it works. And I was like, we've got to get these rented. So I had to kind of become a student of everything that was the management of this. Know a lot about the Airbnb algorithm now, know a lot about what sells in terms of pictures and property, you know, all the things that I kind of had to learn. And a lot of, you know, my friends have asked me, you know, how did you learn that? I'm like, we learned it out of not abundance mindset. It was scarcity fear. I was like, this cannot fail. So therefore I probably have overcompensated and over obsessed a little bit, but that's made it all really successful. And I think for me next, you know, the biggest thing is, you know, what are you going to do now? Everybody kind of asked me that. And I think in order for me to get to the next place, the things that made me successful to get here, obsessing over everything, is probably going to be the downfall of what kind of, you know, carries me to the next place, which is I'm going to have to start to learn to let go, build processes, allow people to come in and do a lot of the things that I'm doing right now. So yeah, I don't know if that answers the question, but there's a lot of things. I could write a book.
Well, so it sounds like a lot of learning by doing and not, you know, this is not a project. It's been wildly successful once you've got it up and running, it sounds like. Mm-hmm. What did you pay for this?
Seven cabins, we were just under $1 million, $975,000, I think. Okay. I sold the one at the bottom for $350,000, I want to say.
So you got a lot of that back.
I got a lot of that back. Currently, I think the loan on it right now is $600,000+ left. The properties, I have about 200 in them. Each. Mm-hmm. I'd assume today, you know, market is what the market is, right? But based on income and just based on comps, the views, the things they've got, I think they should be 425 to 450 pretty easily.
Each, yeah. I agree with that.
Yeah.
So this isn't something that somebody could, like, that you could have hired and said, tell me what to buy. And they could have said, oh, this right here is going to be the best deal in the market. You're going to be able to do all this stuff. Like, there's a lot of, you just had to get in there and do it and learn it and make tweaks as you go. Is that right?
Oh yeah. I got excited about this because I felt like we were going to hedge some risk. I mean, and it sounds weird because it's a rehab project. So there's places in here everywhere that had risk, but we bought it cheap enough. I knew that we could force equity into it. And I knew that that was ultimately going to be what kind of allowed me to, hedge risk on all this, right? I mean, to cash flow one of these things takes $900 a month, $1,000 a month, something like that. I mean, that's my holding. Like, that's everything, all in, $1,000. Wow. So therefore, it just doesn't take a lot to be able to be in a good place. So I knew that on the other side of this, if we could get there, that we were going to be in pretty good shape. And yeah, it was, of course, learning by doing. Like, you know, I'm a PhD professor. So everything I've been taught in my life is, you know, learn as much as you can and then you get tested. And this is like, you get tested and that's how you learn, is by simply making mistakes. Luckily, I had some really good people around me, my father being probably the biggest one, who guided things away from going really astray, which could have easily happened. So.
Okay, then. Well, last three questions of the show.
All right.
What advice would you give 20-year-old, or maybe even 5 years ago, Brian?
Yeah, probably 5 years ago, Brian, is better than 20 years ago, Brian. I think we did that one on the first show.
We did.
Man, looking back, what is the biggest piece of advice? Learn to roll with it. You know, I think, I had kind of an idea in my head, a vision of how I wanted this to go. And in general, it went that way. But there were so many twists and turns along the way that I was not prepared for and ill-equipped to handle at times. And I've been forced to learn to kind of just roll with some of the things that occur here. The biggest being the development that happened around me. Like that threw a big curveball into everything. So,
all right. So what advice, number two, what advice would you give somebody who is a new investor looking to get started today in mid-2024?
It's tough for today. when I did this, man, it just wasn't as hard. At the time, like, you could look at what AirDNA said was going to project on revenue. The prices hadn't escalated to the point where it really was hard to analyze a deal. Like, we were comparing deals at the time, and I was looking at long-term rentals and midterm, or long-term and multifamily over in Oak Ridge. I think we were under contract on one at the time for about the same price point that we were on my first cabin, and looked at it and was like, the numbers on this don't even come close. We're going to buy everything we possibly can, you know, over here in the Smokies. Today it's tougher. And I think people, because it's tougher, they get the idea that you can't find something. And so there's a lot of that that's saturated and it's just impossible and you're not going to be able. Well, I find stuff all the time now, but now I know what I'm looking at, right? Mm-hmm. I've been here for 3.5 years and I kind of know what a good deal looks like now. They still exist. It's harder. And now you've got to do things kind of the old fundamental way of real estate investing, which is look at something and say, can I force equity into this? Can I manage this better than somebody else? Can I add things to this that are going to make it stand out in the market? And if you view things through that lens, there are still a lot of deals out there. It's just, you know, you can't go pluck something from the MLS that's perfect and brand new and make the numbers work usually. So
I would have to agree with that. And last question, what's your favorite book that's impacted your mindset?
Oh man, we did this last time and I don't, you know, since then, I'll be honest, I haven't
had a lot of time to read.
I have not. For those that don't know the story, I was working a full-time job while I was doing this. So I was 2 days a week driving to North Carolina and teaching there as a professor, 2 hours there, 2 hours back. I would listen to podcasts and stuff on the way. And then the rest of the time was up here by me and my dad hammering this stuff out, right? And luckily for me, I had a couple good contractors along the way that kind of came into the fold and helped out a lot. So I haven't read as much. I've been busy as all get out for about, basically since we did the podcast. Now we're coming to the other side of it. So now I'm hoping that I get a little bit of a life back and, can kind of start to enjoy some of the fruits of all of this. So can't say I've read as much, unfortunately.
That's all right. You've been learning in other ways.
I have been learning by doing. Absolutely.
All right, Brian. Well, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.